can't start without that, you know? Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Aquarium. I'm Jerry Schubel, president of the Aquarium. It's great to have all of you here this evening. I want to thank our sponsor, Gazette Newspapers, that makes this lecture series possible. And tonight I'm very pleased to welcome Craig McDonald, who's going to share the story of Jesse Benton Fremont. I don't know whether she's a household word to many of you, but she should be. She's the person who led the effort to protect Yosemite Valley and make it a national park 150 years ago, before John Muir ever heard of Yosemite. And our speaker has been a detective for the last 10 years or more, putting together the case that to recognize this remarkable woman. And he's going to tell you about that case this evening. Our speaker is an historian of the Old West. He's a Pulitzer Prize nominee, a member of the National Honor Society, Phi Alpha Theta, and he's the author of 18 books. Now, he's a writer. The difference between an author and a writer is a writer is someone who makes his or her living writing. An author, anybody can be an author. You can write one book. That doesn't make you a writer. And I think it was Mark Twain who said that the only livelihood less certain than writing is betting on horses. Our speaker is a regular contributor to Sierra Heritage Magazine. His article on the first woman sheriff in Nevada was published in the book, The Historical Nevada Magazine. Other books include Cockeyed Charlie Parkhurst, The West's Most Unusual Stage Whip. And another book is California Gold Rush Glimpses 2, Amazing Tales of People, Life, and Times. He grew up in Northern California, but he's lived in Southern California now for about 30 years. His great-grandmother came across the country in a covered wagon as a young child, so he goes back, and this was during the Gold Rush, he goes back a long way in California. He and his son, Chris, have written a number of stories about this aquarium, and we're very grateful to him for having done that. He went to San Jose State, he played basketball there, and his father, David, was an English professor there, but he majored in social science, and history has always been his passion. And we've had a wonderful discussion with him and his son, Chris, over dinner, and he's going to help us in a number of ways going forward. Please welcome Craig McDonald.
Thank you very much, and thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules, busy lives to come here today to hear about this. I think that's wonderful that you did that. There's so many other things pulling on you, and you came to the right place because I'm a big supporter of the Aquarium of the Pacific and all the innovative programs that they have to try to get people to understand the need to preserve and protect the ocean and marine life and land alongside that. And that's what I'm going to talk to you today about, a woman who recognized the need to preserve and protect an area that became the nation's first park, and that's Yosemite. The woman's name was Jesse Benton Fremont, and she was the daughter of the top Democrat in Washington, Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri. For 30 years, he was an influential senator there in Washington. In fact, he used to drop her off on his way to the Senate to the Library of Congress, where librarians actually helped to educate her. She was largely self-educated. Amazing woman. Ironically, her husband was the Republican Party's first candidate for President of the United States, John C. Fremont, who was a U.S. Senator in California and was famous as a Western explorer. And in 1858, she and her husband went to Bear Valley outside of Mariposa. Have any of you been to Bear Valley by chance? Anybody in the audience or some people in the front row or the near row? A beautiful place. And from there, she went and saw this place called Yosemite. You see, except for the Indians that had been there for thousands of years and the settlers and people coming in the gold rush, most people in the United States and around the world never heard of Yosemite.
So she went off and saw this. These are pictures by a famous Yosemite artist that you're seeing here. And she was just overcome by the beauty of this place. She'd been to Europe. She'd been all over. She'd never seen anything as beautiful as Yosemite. But at the same time, she was gravely concerned because she saw people sawing down some of the ancient redwood trees in what was later known as the Mariposa Grove of giant sequoias. And they were using the lumber to build houses, to homestead, build hotels, plant orchards, create cattle, horse, and sheep ranches in the Yosemite area. And this was back in the late 1850s. And this woman said, I've got to do something about this. And so what she did was start inviting influential men to come meet her and go see this place called Yosemite. Men like Horace Greeley, who I'm sure most of you know or heard about when you're in grade school. Go West, young man, go West. Most people know that chant that he said. He's a famous New York newspaper publisher. He came, met with her. He went and saw Yosemite. He fell in love with it. And he got on the bandwagon to conserve it. In fact, he said that 1,000 years from now, these trees will be more appreciated than they are today if only they could survive. And Richard Henry Dana Jr., have any of you ever heard of him? Dana Point's named after him. And he wrote what is still considered to be the best book ever written on sailing 2 years before the mast. And he was invited to come up to Bear Valley and go see this place called Yosemite. And he too fell in love with it. In 1858 and 1859, she had all sorts of influential people from all over the country that stopped to see Yosemite. In 1860, her husband built her, got her a home overlooking the Golden Gate in San Francisco. And that home became a cultural center for the city of San Francisco. She started having Sunday dinners, teas, and all sorts of events attended by writers like Bret Hart. I'm sure some of you have heard of Bret Hart, the Western writer. Herman Melville, what was the name of that fish? A mammal? Moby Dick? She had all sorts of people there. Have any of you ever heard of Carlton Watkins, by chance? Anybody in the audience? Carlton Watkins is a guy you should really remember, too. He's an unsung hero. He was a photographer, and he actually took pictures for the Fremonts of some of their properties. And he became so turned on to discussions at her house on Yosemite and other issues. They talked about abolishing slavery. They had a whole bunch of issues these people would discuss, but one of them was Yosemite. Carlton Watkins got so turned on by that that he actually took 12 mules full of photographic equipment and went to Yosemite. And he became the first photographer to photograph many of the major aspects of Yosemite. And he came back and they got those magnificent photographs in newspapers, magazines, gallery exhibits in New York City. And eventually, they were featured and won awards at the Paris International Exposition. So what's happening is that people in the United States and around the world are starting to hear about Yosemite and the need to preserve it. Carlton Watkins. Another person that came to her gatherings was Thomas Starr King. He was a Unitarian minister in San Francisco. And he was a great freelance writer. He wrote for the Boston Evening Transcript and other publications and was a great speaker himself. He came regularly and met with Carlton Watkins and these other people meeting at her house. And he went to Yosemite and was absolutely awestruck by its grandeur. He came back and he was going to write a story for the Boston Evening Transcript. By the way, he did his writing in Jesse Benton Fremont's house overlooking the Golden Gate. They were very close friends. He wrote his sermons in there too. He ended up in a two-month period writing 8 feature stories on the beauty of Yosemite. And in his sermons, he talked about scenic conservation. There were so many other interesting people at her gatherings. One man's name was Israel Ward Raymond, who was a New York businessman and became a San Francisco businessman as well. He is the man that ended up writing a letter to U.S. Senator John Conness of California requesting that a bill be prepared to save Yosemite Valley and what became the Mariposa Grove of Giant Sequoias. And then this group lobbied Congress. In fact, she had politicians visiting her at her house, such as Oregon Senator Ed Baker. And I'm thinking, who in the heck is Oregon Senator Ed Baker, and what is he doing in San Francisco? And I found out that Ed Baker was one of Abraham Lincoln's closest friends, that he was a colleague of Lincoln's back in Illinois, and that he, in fact, Lincoln named his second son Baker after him. So here's a man, a politician, a senator, at their house where they're discussing these issues, including Yosemite. So, result of that is that a bill was drawn up, Congress was lobbied, and ironically, without debate, the bill to save Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Grove went through the House and Senate without debate. And 150 years ago, this June 30th, in the middle of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln thought this was important enough to sign the Yosemite Grant Act that saved Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Grove. This was the first time in the world that a federal government saved scenic lands for future generations. And it led to environmental movements. It led to national and state park movements. It was just so significant. One minor detail. The national government had no parks, no park service. The state governments had no parks. So the federal government gave the land to the state of California, and Governor Lowe appointed 8 commissioners to oversee the nation's first park, which was called Yosemite State Park. And if you go to Bolsa Chica State Beach or any of your state parks or state beaches, you'll see the logo on the employees in the trucks of the grizzly bear, and underneath it says since 1864. And if you peel the onion back, you'll finally get to where you'll see that Jesse had involvement in that, along with all the other friends that she was turning on to Yosemite. It's just a remarkable story. What happened was that the Yosemite State Park came into being, and in 1868, which is 4 years after Abraham Lincoln signed that Yosemite Grant Act, a man gets off a boat in San Francisco by the name of John Muir. And he had never heard of Yosemite. And he was talking to a carpenter in San Francisco about wanting to go off into the wilderness and how much he loved it. And the carpenter suggested, why don't you go to Yosemite? And he said, Yosemite? And he told him where it was. And my understanding is that John Muir walked from San Francisco to Yosemite. And he saw the beautiful waterfalls and the amazing rock formations. And he let out a scream. And he just fell in love with the place. And 26 years later, in 1890, John Muir and his friends were able to have created Yosemite National Park. But that was outside of the area of Yosemite State Park. And it didn't include the one area that was the most popular at Yosemite, and that is Yosemite Valley, where the nearly 4 million people go every year. So here you've got these two park systems right next to each other. Kind of a bizarre thing. Well, Jesse, ironically, to fast forward, She kept writing about the Sierra Nevadas. She wrote books. She wrote for Harper's, Atlantic Monthly, a whole bunch of different publications, just a very talented lady. All the time, she also gave birth to 5 children. And she actually ended up down here. She came down here, and her husband died, by the way, in 1890 in New York City, where he's buried in the state of New York. And in 1891, Jessie and her daughter, Elizabeth, who was called Lily, moved to a vine-clad cottage at 28th and Hoover. The actual address is 1101 West 28th at Hoover, for those of you that know that area. And I understand it's USC housing today. In June of 1894, Jessie was made honorary regent of the first Daughters of the American Revolution chapter in Los Angeles. Just to give you a flavor, a local flavor, on August 15, 1897, the LA Times wrote that her cottage, all year around the house is a veritable bower of bloom, perfume of rose, violet, and orange blossoms envelope her like a cloud of incense. She received many prominent guests at her cottage. On May 8, 1901, President William McKinley visited Los Angeles, and an LA Times reporter wrote, "President McKinley left the multitude who gathered to do him honor downtown and drove out to the Fremont Cottage, saying he came to present not only the respects of himself and Mrs. McKinley, but the affection and esteem of the American people." On December 27, 1902, Jessie Benton Fremont died at the age of 78 in that house, 1101 West 28th Street, with Lily at her side. Her body was cremated, and it's interred today at the Rosedale Cemetery at 1831 West Washington Boulevard. On December 28th, the LA Times ran an editorial, or an obituary, a huge feature on her. And on December 30th, funeral services were held at Christ Episcopal Church at Pico and Flower. Amidst 1,000 bunches of violets, huge boxes of roses were sent by Mrs. James Garfield, former First Lady of the United States. Later, an olive tree was planted in her honor in front of the San Fernando Mission. After her mom died, Lily went back to Bear Valley. She went back to Yosemite, but she returned, ironically, to Long Beach. She came here in 1903 because she had 2 relatives here who were architects named Arthur and Ira Benton. And she purchased 2 lots here. And from 1905 to 1907, Lily Benton Fremont lived in a wooden bungalow at 338 Junipero, not far from here, between 3rd and 4th Street. And in 1908, she moved to her second property at Temple and 2nd in Long Beach. In 1909, she moved a lot, this guy. 1909, she went on to Los Angeles. But I just had to tell you that there is a local angle on this. But the thing that's really interesting is that Jessie has never been properly recognized for her behind-the-scenes efforts of getting people together. And I did a lot of research on this, and I ended up breaking the story on this in Sierra Heritage Magazine in April 2012, and went to Congressman Jeff Denham, who had Yosemite in his district, and he spoke in Congress about Jessie and her role, and his staff did research and did a really great job on the speech. Then we went to the National Parks Promotions Council, and they featured Jessie on the cover of their Women's History Month newsletter, and they said that there are a lot of women who didn't get the credit that they should have in the 19th century for their role in helping create parks, you know, especially Jessie. And then with redistricting, we knew a new congressman was going to be taking over Yosemite, Tom McClintock, a Republican who had Lake Tahoe, and he inherited Yosemite. And we contacted him months ahead of time, gave him the information and everything. And the very first bill that he introduced in Congress in 2013 was H.R. 1192 to rename a mountain peak after Jesse Benton Fremont. That bill sort of remained floating around, as things do in Congress. And about a year later, which is this year, the House Natural Resources Committee unanimously approved the bill. And ironically, there was one group that was against the bill, the National Park Service, which is very interesting because they might not have a job if it hadn't have been for Jesse Benton Fremont. The National Park Service said that Jesse Benton Fremont had no direct or long-term association with the mountain that was going to be named after her, and they are correct. It's called Mammoth Peak, and I don't know if any of you know Mammoth Peak. If south of Tuolumne Meadows, east of Yosemite Valley, it's 12,100 and something feet tall. And it's named Mammoth because it's big. It has no significance whatsoever. It's just big. So several of the people that used to come to her house for those Sunday dinners became famous for their work in helping to save Yosemite. And they have mountain peaks named after them. But Jesse doesn't have one. It's really interesting because Jesse never sought credit for what she was doing. She didn't care who got the credit. She would bring influential men together. She would feed them ideas and kind of facilitate, and they would come up with their own ideas, and as a result, all these good things started to happen. But she was behind the scenes and is linked to just about everything you can think of at this time involving saving Yosemite. There was a time even involving Abraham Lincoln in 1862 when she sat on the stage near Abraham Lincoln at the Smithsonian Institute. And Horace Greeley was giving a lecture. And it wasn't on Yosemite, it was on something else, but she arranged to have a reception at her hotel for Abraham Lincoln and Horace Greeley and herself. And even though there's not a piece of paper that I've been able to find on what went on, it's not like nowadays where everyone has a cell phone, they're taking pictures, recording conversations, etc. I sure would have liked to known what went on in that conversation about Yosemite. But what happened was that there it was, January 30th, 1864, and President Lincoln is signing the legislation. So the battle continues to try to get her some type of recognition. There's not even a tree named for her at Yosemite. And 1192, I have good news for you that it was just passed in July by the House of Representatives to rename the mountain peak after her. So now it's in the Senate, and it was given to a Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. So the effort continues, but it sure would be nice to have some type of recognition for her on her 150th anniversary of helping to save Yosemite, even though she's doing it behind the scenes. She was just a remarkable woman. She ran her husband's presidential campaign in 1856 to tell you what kind of lady she was. In fact, John C. Fremont almost became president of the United States. There were two states. Isn't this what happens every election year? There are always two states that are supposed to be voting for a candidate that don't vote for him, and so somebody loses, whether it's city council or, you know, whatever. You know what I'm talking about. There's always like two votes or two states, and I think it was Pennsylvania and Illinois that didn't come through for John C. Fremont. But what's interesting is her dad, top Democrat, and other Democrats were so worried that John C. Fremont would be elected president that he said to the media and the public that if John C. Fremont is elected president of the United States, there will be a woman in the White House running this country, that she wore the pants in the family, and that she made the decisions. And you know what? He was absolutely correct. There would have been a woman running this country in 1857. It might have been the best thing to ever happen. to the United States of America. But history is really, really interesting. I can go on and on and tell you different things about Jessie. As I said earlier, she was basically self-educated. Her dad and mom educated her. They brought in masters and that taught languages. And when she was 16, she was translating documents from James Buchanan, who was Secretary of State, into French and Spanish. There was nothing that this woman couldn't do. And there are various stories on how she met John C. Fremont. One of the most interesting is that her father introduced the two of them at a U.S. Army mapping meeting. And she was a beautiful 16-year-old girl. He was a handsome 26-year-old lieutenant in the Army. And the senator saw sparks flying between the two. And he took Jessie aside after that meeting and said, "Jessie, I forbid you to see him. You stay away from him and you don't communicate." Well, here he's like so powerful in Washington, but his own daughter kept writing to Lieutenant Fremont, and they ended up eloping in 1841, getting married in Washington, D.C. I mean, there's just so many fascinating stories about her and the role that she played. But the question is, what if she didn't play this role? What if these people never got together? Would there ever be a Yosemite National Park? Would there be a Yosemite State Park? If Yosemite became private property, as she thought it would, and if those ancient trees in the Mariposa Grove got sawed down, I wonder what John Muir would have said. I wonder if that would have had a bearing on the creation of Yosemite. But anyway, I'll open this up to questions that any of you might have, and I have more information that I can tell you. I'll tell you one thing here before I do that, and that is that the Sierra Club came out and said that Galen Clark, Yosemite's first official guardian, who John Muir called the greatest mountaineer he ever knew, said the Yosemite grant wouldn't have happened without Jessie. And Galen Clark, who I'm sure most of you have heard of, who was the first official guardian of Yosemite, and he was a dear friend of Jessie Benton Fremont, he said it wouldn't have happened without her. And he wrote in his remembrances, in 1880, Mrs. Fremont and Israel Ward Raymond were the most active workers on the Yosemite Park proposal. And Victor Knox, the associate director of the National Park Service, testified in Congress earlier this year that Jessie Benton Fremont was an important figure in the advocacy for and the establishment of the Yosemite grant. And the California State Parks historians wrote, "Jessie's vital influence helped conserve one of California's greatest treasures, Yosemite. Her friends and followers became infected with her passion to preserve Yosemite. She herself pressed Lincoln to act. Her perseverance and vision contributed to the creation of the Yosemite grant, which inspired John Muir to lobby for national parks." And I'll leave you with one other item. John Bicknell wrote in Roll Call, "Jessie's contributions to Yosemite and the West go far beyond fundraising and advocacy. They go to the heart of how we understand and appreciate the natural world, which is worth a mountain." So if you would like to see her finally get her due, please contact Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer, because now that this is in the Senate, we need them to carry it through the Senate and have President Obama sign it. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for questions. Who has the first one? Nancy?
And we'll get you next.
When Lincoln put it into the grant, what kind of enforcement was there? I mean,
That's really an interesting question. You know, sometimes I get that stated a little bit differently, like what happened to the landowners that had their big ranches in the whole thing? Because when that occurred, all of a sudden you couldn't have land anymore. So people that had the land, James Hutchins is a great example. California Illustrated Magazine, some of you might have seen, and you can buy it in book form. Hal North came out with a book form of his beautiful magazines. James Hutchins had 120 acres at Yosemite, Yosemite Valley. All of a sudden, you're not supposed to be able to own private property. He raised holy heck. What do most people do in a situation like that? They sue. So he started suing, and it went through the whole court system up until December 1870, when the United States Supreme Court ruled that homesteader land holdings were invalidated. Some people just left. They said, well, okay, we'll leave. They didn't make a big stink. James Hutchins kept his stink going. So that instead of this court system, they went after the legislature. This sounds like today, kind of. And they were hooting and moaning, and actually, this is our land, and we've got our, you know, all this. So in 1872, the California State Legislature put aside $60,000 to compensate people who had lost their land. And the one who got the most money was James Hutchins, who shouted the most. He got $24,000. So basically, and then later on you have the National Park Service come into being, and you had you had all the other entities that you've heard about. The Calvary and the, yeah.
I want to thank you for telling us about this lady. I had no idea that she'd done so much. My question is kind of unrelated. On many of these paintings here, it says with Milford Zorn.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Do you know anything yes. about that connection?
Yeah. Milford Zorn, for those of you that don't know, was one of the fathers of the California style of watercolor. And I knew Milford Zorns. And his best friend the last 15 years of his life was Bill Anderson, who did these paintings. Bill Anderson drove him, as a matter of fact, to Yosemite, where Milford Zorns put on painting classes. And Bill did too, where the students go out and paint Half Dome, and then they come back in and analyze them. And so that's the connection. Milford Zorn's an amazing man. He promised the California Museum of Pasadena Museum of California Art that he would put on a painting demonstration when he was 100. And he did this when he was in his 90s. And he had a rough couple of years making it to 100. He had a lot of physical problems. But when Milford Zorns was 100 years old, he went to the Pasadena Museum of California Art and put on a painting demonstration, and then he died like a month later. Just a remarkable man. Bill Anderson has an art gallery in Sunset Beach, California. It's part of Captain Jack's restaurant, but it faces the front, and it's only open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But Bill Anderson's a world-famous artist. His works are the National Museum of Watercolor in Mexico City and all over. In his small gallery, he has Milford Zorn's artwork, and also Raul Anguiano, who when he was alive was Mexico's most famous living muralist. So it's a real gem if you ever get into Sunset Beach. But that's the connection with Milford Zorns. You're welcome.
Hi, thank you very much. I really enjoyed your speech so far. And I am a substitute teacher for a local school district, and one of my units I wrote was on Yosemite for third grade class. And I was wondering, because so much in the units was focused towards the Native American lifestyle, did she have any influence on protecting that original culture?
Actually, she
while
did.
While preserving the parks also.
Yeah, actually she did. It's kind of interesting. Lily that I was telling you about, her name's really Elizabeth Lily Benton Fremont, the daughter that always was remained loyal to the mom and dad, never married, and was always helping them doing all sorts of stuff. When she was either in Long Beach or had moved to Los Angeles, she ended up donating a whole bunch of stuff to the Southwest Museum. I believe there's a lot of Indian cultural, Native American cultural stuff. There's some really, really great stories. I'm trying to remember. where that one was. Let's see. There was one. I think it was near what's in current-day Wyoming, where she actually used part of her wedding dress to create a symbol of, like a flag, that Fremont actually took with him on one of his expeditions. And when they moved to Bear Valley, she was great friends with the Native Americans there. They actually painted her house. It's kind of a funny story. They painted her house white. And here she almost got to be in the real White House in Washington, D.C. So I'd say she ended up at the White House in Bear Valley. Native Americans were the children, and the families would come over there. She'd have events for them all the time in the holiday seasons. The Native Americans would bring baskets, and she'd fill them with clothes and food. And I know John C. Fremont and both of them one time, and I don't remember where it was, but they actually provided food, making sure that a particular group of Indians were fed. So there was a bond with Jesse Benton Fremont and the Indians. Now, Southwest Museum, as you know, was taken over, whatever you want to call it, by the Autry. And so you might check that out. You might go there because the Autry has some sensational Native American outfits and exhibits and displays. And there's probably stuff from Lily Fremont's donations that were from her family. They were her mom's and her dad's.
Who has the next one?
Thank you for your talk. So from what I've read about 19th century conservation efforts, something of like Teddy Roosevelt and people like that, that a lot of what people say is that there's these ideals of kind of like rugged masculinity that are going into it, this idea that it, you know, wilderness was for exploration, all these kind of typically masculine things. I'm just wondering if you happen to know, was she, Fremont, that is, you know, was she able to make any sort of typically feminine appeals, or sort of what was her angle on why wilderness should be preserved?
You know, she actually sided with her dad. Senator Thomas Hart Benton was one of the biggest advocates of manifest destiny, you know, and she actually kind of sided with him on that in most of the things that I saw. From a feminine standpoint, she was the mother of five children. Two of her children died. But she helped educate them just like her mom had helped educate her. And the Los Angeles Times had an article that I thought was pretty interesting. And I don't know if I have that in my pages right here, but basically what it did, what it said, was that she helped get the wages increased for women employees in the White House and in Washington in general, So that's actually documented in an LA Times story that I probably have in another folder here. From a feminine standpoint, she was very feminine, very, she loved flowers, she loved help. She loved kids and helping other kids. She loved Native Americans. That doesn't really answer your question exactly like you'd stated, but her mom, it's kind of interesting, was the daughter of the governor of Virginia. And it was her mom who first got her excited about the idea of abolishing slavery. You need to abolish slavery. And she really, and John C. Fremont too, they wanted to abolish slavery, and they got into trouble with all sorts of politicians, clear up to President Lincoln, because they abolished slaves early. In some areas where they were working, you know, as far as the slavery in Missouri, and oh my gosh, there's some great stories if you want to look into that. But she was just really into everything. She was one of the most remarkable women in the history of the world, as far as I can figure. I'm still learning new things about her after having kind of studied her for over 10 years. And they're best-selling books on her. I recommend several best-selling books on her. And you can go on the internet and get all the names. The first one came out in 1944, and it's called Immortal Wife, and it's a novel. So it's sort of, you know, there you create conversations. I can't create conversations. I'd like to create them for you, but there you can see how an author created conversations. That was a very popular book. And there have been several books written on her since then that really go into detail about who she was, what she thought, what she did, where she went. She traveled a lot. She wrote a bunch of books herself. One's called Far West Sketches, which goes into the Sierra Nevada, if you like the Sierra Nevada, and all these incidents and things that happened involving her husband, the mining properties, and the Sierra. But the way she described trees when she went to Mariposa Grove, and you can read this on the internet. I think you probably just look it up on the internet. You don't have to actually track down the book in a library or whatever, but she was just a beautiful writer. She was just sensational. And if any of you have ever heard of the famous muralist Thomas Hart Benton, he was named, if you go to Nashville and you go to the National Cowboy Hall, I think it's the National, what is it? What's in Nashville? It's the National Country Music Hall of Fame, I believe. That was the last painting that the famous Thomas Hart Benton, who was named after his grand uncle that was her dad, and this artist named his daughter Jessie. Isn't that, I mean, this is fascinating stuff. Thomas Hart Benton, the muralist, he's very famous for his murals and stuff. The last thing he did, I understand, was this huge mural in that museum, the Cowboy Western Old, what is it called? The Hall of Fame. Yeah, in Nashville. And in fact, I understand it was just a beautiful, beautiful mural. And he went out to put like his name on it one evening and never came back. He died. But what a fitting end for an artist. But yeah, that's, thank you for your question. Yeah.
I read the Irving Stone
book. Irving Stone, yeah.
Just wonderful.
Yes, that's a great book.
What a dynamic woman.
Oh, yeah.
But to answer your question about her femininity, I think it was her skill of hospitality.
You're right,
Bring people together and then sit back and just be the hostess and let wonderful things happen right there in her living room.
You're exactly right. She learned when she was a kid. And as I told you, her dad would drop her off at the Library of Congress, not a bad place to be dropped off when he was going to the Senate. She learned from her dad so much. He was a master politician. He took her in to meet presidents one-on-one. I guess it'd be two-on-one. But he took her to meet two or three different presidents that way. He took her into the smoke-filled rooms. This is a girl. I mean, she's like 13 years old or, you know, like just... She learned how politics was done. She learned how everything's about chemistry, that you need to bring the right people together. That's the secret to success. Not saying, hey, look, I did it. She never tooted her own horn, which has made it very difficult for me. I wish she tooted her own horn because someone should have written this article 100 years ago. But I haven't found a piece of paper where she wrote exactly what she was trying to do. She was never tooting her own horn. If you know who made John C. Fremont, and do you know who his scout was? Kit Carson. Do you know who made them famous? Jesse. Jesse ghost wrote all their books. They're maps of the West. She would sit down with them, and they had all the information. She didn't go out on these expeditions, you know. And she would just know how to put it into prose. She was just a pro. And when John C. Fremont screwed up, he was a bad businessman. And he bet most of the family's money on a transcontinental railroad that sounded like a good thing to do, but he picked the wrong railroad and lost the shirt. Who came riding on the white horse? The mother of five, Jesse Benton Fremont. She'd start writing for Atlantic and Harper's and Out West and a whole bunch of different magazines supporting the family. And she's just remarkable. I mean, the more you find out about her, the more amazed you'll be. This really should be a television show. It should be a major epic movie or series if you're the producer in the audience. I mean, this has not been touched, and it is absolutely incredible. But the problem is, she never tried to take credit for anything. But you always kind of find out she was there when something was going on. Or she was like a hub, and there were spokes going off to all these people getting credit for doing all the stuff. But there was Jesse, and you're thinking, what was Jesse? I wish I knew exactly what she was doing there. But she was bringing them together. She was encouraging them. And I'm going to tell you what John W. Henneberger, who was National Park Historian and former Associate Director of the National Park Service, said in his State of State Parks in 2000, that Jesse's role was that of a catalyst and a muse, prodding and encouraging men such as Thomas Starr King to write and speak as she could not in a period when women were expected to inspire rather than create. It's just absolutely unbelievable. The Sacramento Bee has come out and many newspapers in favor of having this mountain named after her. And like I say, if you want to help in that effort, please just write a note or email Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer and just say, please help this get through the Senate. All I'm trying to do is get this lady recognition so 100 years from now, somebody will realize that there was a very important woman involved in this movement to save the nation's first park.
We have a question here.
Well, it sounds like you were wrapping it up. So.
No, I'm wide open. Go ahead.
Well, speaking to the point of John C. Fremont not doing well financially, at one time they had gold mines and they had
right.
all kinds of, but in the end, I understand John C. Fremont died alone in
right.
a boarding house in New York, and Jesse down here in Southern California
right.
Lived in a very humble cottage and really was almost destitute, but still kept her pride and her beauty and, as you say, entertained important people in her little tiny cottage.
President of the United States yeah. came to see her.
But
right there, yeah.
Financially, she did not.
She didn't. She kept writing. She kept writing as long as she could, but the women, it's called quote unquote, the women of Los Angeles purchased a house for her that she moved into after her husband died. And Congress gave her a $2,000 stipend from his retirement, being a military officer and stuff. So she received $2,000 a month, supposedly, along with the house. And it was just beautiful. I was reading you the descriptions. Anybody that wants to know more afterwards, come up and see me and I can give you some of these descriptions, but all flowers all around. And there are pictures at USC and California Historical Society of this house. And speaking of her daughter, Lily, this house that's at 338 Juniper, I understand, still stands. Well, you hesitate to say that because you don't know what a bulldozer did yesterday, right?
No.
But if you go by 338 Juniper tonight or whatever, between 3rd and 4th, you'll probably see the exact house with the porch and the whole thing. That's kind of interesting. Where Lily.
Craig, we have another question back
yeah,
here.
Sure.
I actually have two questions.
Sure.
When Yosemite was first established, some African American cavalry soldiers were first protectors. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
Also, I think James Fremont's nickname was Frontier Fremont. Was that true?
You know, I've never seen him as Frontier Fremont. That might very well be. He had a lot of nicknames. The Pathfinder. There are several nicknames that he had. I'm not sure about that one. Could be true. I've researched more of Jesse Fremont than John C. Fremont. There's so many books out on John C. Fremont and so much information. Unless they relate to Jesse and Yosemite, you know, you can probably verify that pretty easily, even on the internet, if you just type that in the internet and see the answer on that one. Yeah.
We have another one here.
Huh? Thank you. Thank you for coming. This has been very interesting. My family has been going to Yosemite since the 40s of the previous century.
Wow.
But my question is, you had mentioned that she went to visit Yosemite. It didn't sound like she visited often. Did she just get the vision and get the inspiration?
You know, she did. It wasn't like, first of all, it was several miles to get to Yosemite. And, you know, the travel issues. And plus the fact she had kids. You know, she had the different kids, so she didn't get there as often as she would like to. But if you look at some of the books that she's written or magazine articles, they're absolutely incredible how she describes the first time she sees the giant sequoias in Mariposa Grove. And, I mean, you would love doing that. And you'd probably go just on the internet and find that type of description. So she just really loved. In fact, there was a thing that she said that I'm going to find for you right now. Glimpses of Yosemite Valley in the morning freshness made us glad we were alive. Isn't that neat? That's what Jesse Benton Fremont, she just loved every aspect of Yosemite. And it's too bad that, you know, what happened was she ended up going to San Francisco where her husband had bought her house and this stuff I described to you there. But then the Civil War comes along. So he is, you know, made, put in charge of the West, you know, and he has to go back to St. Louis. So she has to go back to St. Louis. She didn't want to leave. She really didn't want to leave, you know, either Bear Valley or where I was in the Army, and, you know, the Army base that was right there where her house is overlooking the Golden Gate. Yeah. She never wanted to leave that. She really didn't want to leave that. And these people didn't want her to leave. The Thomas Starr Kings and all these Herman Melville when he was in town and all these people I mentioned, she had a regular thing going there. And it's hard to leave and pull up your roots and go back there. She lived everywhere, by the way. She lived in Washington, D.C., in St. Louis. She lived in Arizona a little bit. Her husband was put in charge of Arizona. Remember that little episode in the life? She didn't really care for it. She went to New York. She lived in New York. She lived in San Francisco, Bear Valley, just all over the place. So she was kind of on the move. Maybe that's where Lily got it from with her moving around.
Greg, we have another one here. Yeah.
I was curious, was she an only child?
She had a sister. I believe she had a sister. Yeah, I've forgotten the...
So there were no boys.
Her then. Family. I don't think so. But it's kind of interesting you mention that because... She had five children, like I mentioned, and one of them, John C. Fremont Jr., was a Naval Academy graduate who became an admiral. And the interesting thing is that he had a daughter, Juliet Fremont Hall, who was born in 1888 and died in 1971. So it's kind of interesting that people ask me, well, does she still have relatives? And if you're a genealogist and if you just go on the internet, you'll see people that say they're the relatives. In fact, I got an email from a woman in Australia who had read a Los Angeles Times article about this Natural Resources Committee that quoted me and stuff like that earlier this year. She said, I'm a relative of Jesse Benton Fremont's, and I really applaud what you're doing because she really does deserve recognition, whether she wanted it or not. People need to know. So people are kind of coming out of the woodworks that say they're relatives of hers. We have another
one. Was she an advocate for any other parks?
There were no other parks. But you mean after the fact? After the fact. She moved around and did different things with her husband and his various jobs and stuff like that. She kept writing pretty much about Sierra Nevada. And Washington, D.C. that she knew about. I don't know about her taking up the cause of trying to establish Yellowstone, which became the first national park. But that's a good question. I don't really know the answer on that.
We'll take one more. Does anybody have one? Okay, give me a second to get over here.
Did you say that Yellowstone is part national park and part state park?
Oh, no, I said Yellowstone was the first national park.
Not
then I said the nation's first park was Yosemite State Park, because there were no other parks. There were no national or state parks.
Okay, that's what I meant, Yosemite. Yeah. Is it part state now or national?
No, it was Yosemite State Park at the beginning that Jesse and her friends helped to create. And then 26 years later, in 1890, John Muir and his friends were able to get Yosemite National Park created, but that was outside of the state park. It was outside the boundaries of Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Grove. And then, to tie it all together, people have seen that picture of Teddy Roosevelt. They think he started the state, you know, the national park. In 1903, John Muir invited President Teddy Roosevelt to come and spend some days with him, go camping with him at Yosemite. And that's where that famous picture, they're standing on a rock together and all this and that. And John Muir was lobbing him on the need to unite both parks. And it helped because in 1906, I think, yeah, it's 1906, the state gave back the state park. It gets confusing. I know state gave back the state park into the federal government, and they made it part of Yosemite National Park. But yeah, it was really confusing. It's a lot of controversy. If you want controversy, take a look at the running of the state park and various issues there and politics involved and the national park. And I mean, it was better. Thank goodness they brought it together.
Greg, thank you. Wonderful story. You just wonder how many Jessies there are out there who've never gotten credit for all the important things they've done. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you very much. It was a joy. Thank you.